Chris Colbert has a long and deep track record of using his understanding of technology, innovation, and humanity to build brands and high-performing organizations. His career story includes founding several startups, leading two brand and direct marketing agencies, and overseeing a strategic revamp of Scholastic's core book club publishing business. In 2015, he joined the Harvard Innovation Labs, where he served as managing director, supporting hundreds of student and alumni-led startups. He is the author of the new book, Technology is Dead, The Path to a More Human Future, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Chris Colbert to the roundtable this morning. Chris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
What brought you to want to take a look at this subject and the way that you decided to take a look at it?
I was used to be the managing director of the Harvard Innovation Lab and was there from 2015 to 2019. Along the way, I was invited to speak at the largest financial technology conference in the world and as a keynote. And I realized in preparing my talk, which ultimately was titled Technology is Dead, that from my work at Harvard, I've come to understand that most innovation fails not because of the ability to build the thing, but because of the inability to get humans to adopt the thing. And more generally, I began looking at technology over the course of the last few decades and realized that for all of the positives technology has rendered as a form of innovation, it has also created a multitude of unintended consequences. And the reason for that is because the technologists and the innovators did not put sufficient effort into understanding the human part of the equation. So they built it and they unleashed it. And in unleashing it, they realized both positive things and they effectively stimulated or created maybe not so positive things. And so the entire book is really a call to action for all of us, whether you're a technologist, an innovator, or just a member of the general public, to try to put more human understanding at the forefront of our efforts to improve the world versus wait at the end for the consequence of the unintended consequences.
Subtitle of the book is The Path to a More Human Future. How hard is that given what has been unleashed?
On one level, it might be impossible. And on another level, it's completely doable beginning today. The impossibility is around the complexity of reimagining all the systems and governing forms that guide our world. I mean, look at the challenges that we're having around AI and creating guardrails and guiding lights for AI. And that's just one piece of the technological, you know, landscape that we find ourselves in. So sort of reimagining how the whole thing works is brutally complicated and maybe even impossible, as I said. On the other end is the ability for each of us to simply be more human in our daily actions and interactions, which sounds corny and trite, but I really do believe one of the unintended consequences of technology is the atomization and anonymization of society. And one way to offset that is to say hello to strangers, to care more about our neighbors, to hug our family members, to simply try to break out of the transaction mindset and the very individual mindset that technology is unintendedly created by being more oriented towards the whole, towards the collective, and towards the other, whether the other is somebody on the street that you've never met, or the other is a person sitting across the table from you in the kitchen.
A question that you address in the book, of course, is how did we end up here? And I'm curious as to how those who were unleashing that technology, what the plan was and what the hope was. And is it that they didn't realize of this unintended consequence or they didn't care about this unintended consequence?
Ooh, that's a good question, Joe. I think it's a couple of things. One, I theorize in the book that much of the innovation that has occurred since humans first discovered the power of fire, early on it was fueled by the desire to survive. I think later it became all about economic growth. And implicit in that was the need for more speed. And so if the presumption was that the technology made things faster, it was going to be better for all mankind. And the real issue in that was, I think, twofold. One is no agreement as a species on what the intention of innovation is generally, and technological innovation specifically, beyond economic growth. And the second is, to your point about just not understanding that there might be unintended consequences, not looking at the innovation through the lens of human need and, more importantly, human vulnerability. And, you know, the example I use is Sean Parker is one of the founders of Facebook,
right,
was quoted as saying, "We knew we had a multi-billion dollar business on our hands when we realized social media was all about was all about validation." Preying on human need for validation, human ego, wanting to be accepted by others, wanting to be recognized by others. And so I think in some cases we didn't comprehend the potential unintended consequences. In other cases, like Facebook, there was an acknowledgement early on that this was going to prey on people's needs. And I don't know that they understood how unhealthy that would end up being, but that they certainly had an indicator that that's where this thing was headed.
The whole idea, I mean, just the name of the book, Technology is Dead. Is that wishful thinking, or what is the state of technology right now?
The point of the title at one level was simply to be provocative when I was on that stage in Singapore talking to 10,000 people. But implicit in it is this idea that we operate today as if technology is alive, that it is a sort of essential part of who we are as human beings. And my point is, it's not. It's dead. It's inanimate. It isn't alive. We make it alive by how we allow it to infiltrate, insinuate itself into every part of who we are. And that's maybe okay if we're clear on what it is we want from technology and manage it accordingly, and we're clear on what it is we don't want from technology and manage it accordingly. But we have not done that. We have simply allowed the beast out of the box and into our lives. And again, it's created some amazingly positive things for society and ourselves. But we have my view is we have an opportunity / responsibility to be far more intentional how we make it part of who we are and how we are, and how we make it part of our children's lives. I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations I have with parents today of 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds, and the struggle they are having to figure out what is the appropriate protocol, if you will, on when and how to allow their kids to have phones. And I think that's a good example of we just let it go, and all of a sudden it's embedded, and all of a sudden we have children with mental health issues, children struggling in school, children dealing with, you know, depression and loneliness. And it's all because we haven't stepped forward and taken back, if you will, the stewardship of this force.
Chris Colbert is our guest. The name of the book is Technology is Dead. I find it fascinating because it seems as though we're at a place where we're trying to figure all this out. And you talk in the book about how we should look at community leaders and parents and young people, as well as CEOs and politicians, to try to help lead us out of this predicament. And what I find interesting, and let's not, certainly, Chris, not to pick on politicians. However, let me just say that whenever I see a subcommittee meeting or a committee meeting in the United States Senate or House, it is striking to me of how there are calls for regulation, and yet there is such a lack of knowledge about the technology and about the technology that they're looking to regulate. And that seems to have been going on for a really long time.
Really long time.
I don't know how you get past that if the people who are supposed to be regulating it don't even understand it?
Well, you know how in the old days, and it's still used, that refer to higher education as the ivory tower.
Right.
I actually think our government, and particularly what's happening on Capitol Hill, is the ultimate ivory tower. And I won't get into which side of the thing I'm on, but regardless of Democrat or Republican, I think the level of disconnection from the truth of the citizenry, the truth of technology and how it's impacting the citizenry, I just think they're in an ivory tower. And I what's bizarre to me is, you know, they all have sort of taken a pledge to represent the country, to represent their constituents, what have you, and yet they have no idea what the reality is. They have no idea, again, to your point about they don't understand technology, they don't understand people, they don't understand their fears, they don't understand their wants. It's a real, you know, disconnection from the other, I think, is the most fundamental issue we have as a species, whether it's within the confines of a country or between countries. We are just remarkably, as I said, atomized and anonymized. And we can all make that a little less problematic by simply trying harder to understand the other. If all of our politicians would just try harder to understand what it's like to be a mother of three living in pick a place, and the challenges of today's reality, both made harder by technology, in some cases made easier by technology, that would be a huge step forward.
What I also wonder is, and again, not just politicians, but of how we all live in this world, and we live in this world that sees technology, and how you can be unaware of its power, how you can be unaware of what it brings with us, to me is frightening in and of itself.
Yeah, there's an inkling. This goes back to human understanding. There's a section in the book titled Decoding Humans. And it's my sort of hack psychologist attempt to, I borrow Maslow a lot, and just sort of try to dissect what underpins our behaviors. And we're very, in a way, simple creatures, and we want things to be simpler, and we will quickly jump to something that we think we perceive as causing, potentially having the benefit of simplification, or the benefit of faster, or the benefit of more convenient, without much in the way of consideration of downstream effect. I mean, if you look at, I mean, here's one: the retirement savings rate among Americans is horrifying, and it's kind of the same thing, which is, it's simpler for me to buy the sofa I've always wanted than it is to put money aside for something that's 30 years from now.
Mm.
The latter takes will, you know, takes restraint, takes commitment, takes premeditation. And we have a bias towards just grabbing things that make us feel better now. Sacrifice ain't our forte. It just isn't. And so technology is fed on that truth, that human truth. And my argument later in the book is we've got to get on the other side of that somehow, some way. And sadly, more often than not, what causes humans to take sacrifice is necessity, in the form of a war, in the form of a pandemic, in the form of some threat that is bigger than us, that causes us to say, you know what, survival, the collective, is now more important than what makes it easier or more enjoyable for me. Therefore, I'm going to put down my phone and pick up my whatever, you know.
You write, in our quest to innovate, to succeed, to make millions, we delude ourselves into thinking that our customer is simple, when in actual fact he or she is decidedly not. The real problem in solving problems is that humans are complicated, really, really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So this gets back to an early question of, so how do we come to terms with that and realize of those behaviors and predilections and biases?
It's a great question. I mean, I think we start with trying to understand the other. You know, my terrible example is I got divorced 25 years ago, and I came to realize after being divorced that the issue was not a lack of love. It was a lack of understanding. That my ex-wife and I did not work hard enough to really understand the other. Yes, we are complicated. Even my point about where we seek simplicity, there's a lot of complexity into why it is we seek simplicity. My point, though, is if we all just stopped and looked at the other, whether the other is a significant other, the other is your business partner, the other is your customer, the other is your vendor, the other is whomever, and simply tried harder through questioning to understand their truth, their reality, their wants, their desires, their fears, their needs, their shame, their whatever, the likelihood that we could engage with that person ongoing in a constructive and healthy way would significantly improve. I mean, it reminds me when I first got to Harvard, when I had a bunch of direct reports, and right out of the gate in my first one-on-ones with them, I would ask them, Joe, how do you feel? And at first they were like, why are you asking me that question?
Mm.
And because that's how I know you. That's how I understand whether you're happy at work, not happy at work, whether you're clear about what we're trying to do as an organization, whether you're motivated, whether you're satisfied, whether you're frustrated, the feeling thing is real. But as a species, we've made feeling not part of the equation, or we've tried to make it not part of the equation, and we made not truly understanding the other seemingly not important to our effort to progress. And I think that's not right. I think understanding the other, even though the other is really complicated, is kind of the only way out of the mess. That's at an individual level or at a societal level.
So let me ask about that. Well, both individual and societal, I guess. So if we, the customer, the user, the human, what is our role in this? What is our responsibility in this?
I think we all, I mean, this is maybe a trite answer. I think we all have a responsibility to not be afraid. Because really what we're talking about is exposure. If I seek to understand you as my friend, I'm asking you to expose that about yourself. And in exposing that about yourself, I expose my ability to handle whatever it is you say, or however you describe how you are, or how you feel. It's uncomfortable for people, and in a way, it's a form of sacrifice. You know, walking into engagements with the other that get to that level of intimate sharing is uncomfortable, and because it's uncomfortable, that's sacrifice. That's sacrifice of comfort. When I was at Harvard, I oversaw the Innovation Lab, and we was an incubator for startups. And the number one thing I would say to the young people who are starting startups, and these are Harvard students from all 12 schools, very, very bright kids, obviously. The number one thing I would tell them to do is go meet with their target customer.
Mm.
Go out and sit with the human that you are building something for, and make sure you understand them as well as you understand yourself, and maybe even more so. And they wouldn't do it. I mean, sometimes they would do it, but 99% of the time, they didn't do it.
Your answer of don't be afraid is far from trite, but it's also complicated by the fact that, let's just use AI as an example. I can point to 22 articles today in any number of quote-unquote mainstream publications that tell us to be scared as hell.
Yep.
So I assume there's a balance there somewhere.
Well, I mean, when I say don't be afraid, I'm not saying don't be afraid of technology. I'm saying don't be afraid of trying to understand the other. I think we should be afraid of technology, but not to the point of paralysis. I think we need to use it as a motivator to step forward and say, this is enough. Enough of unleashing these beasts with no consideration of how they will prey on our vulnerabilities. Enough. And the point you mentioned earlier is I don't think our governments, our politicians, have the chops to do this. And so the only way this actually gets to a better place is via what I'll call a grassroots movement of people saying enough. You know, it's just too much. So on the one hand, we have to overcome our fear of interacting intimately with the other to understand them. And on the other hand, we should be afraid of these technologies, but to the point of, again, not of paralysis, but of action. So just to clarify.
When you look at a film like Social Dilemma, and that's something I show in my classes, and it's a documentary about social media, and I think what's so telling about it is that the people who created this stuff are telling you to be wary. They've dropped out. They're scared of what they've unleashed.
Oh, yeah.
As we wrap up, I guess I'm interested in what their responsibility is in telling us. I mean, there's one line in that documentary where I think it was the person who developed the like button just said, I feel like I've just done a horrible thing. And the first thing I want to do is just to make sure my kids don't get anywhere near it.
And I think that, I don't know if it was Sean Parker, but Sean Parker eventually, you know, he's become an activist for a lot of what I'm trying to say in the book. Like we have to, you know, there's a great quote from a guy named Ash Carter, who was Obama's Secretary of Defense, and he and I spoke at a conference at Harvard when I was there. And the quote is simple. He said, technology cannot be slowed, but it must be steered.
Hmm.
And I think that's exactly right. I don't think we can slow this sucker down, but we've got to figure out how to steer it. I mean, even Sam Altman in OpenAI has acknowledged the dark side of this thing. He's not all peaches and cream about how this is going to unfold. But again, the dilemma is we don't have the governing mechanisms to step into this. U.S. couldn't even sort out data privacy, you know, regulations. How are we going to handle something as complex as AI? And I don't have, back to your first good question, I don't have the answer really to that. But I do believe if just more of us step forward as humanist activists and say, we need more human understanding. My kids are in school, more schools, more particularly middle schools, but more schools are beginning to not allow kids having phones in school. And, you know, if your school system is not doing that and you're a parent, then get activist. And that's a step. You know, I mean, the good news is there are billions of people on this planet. We only need around 10% of them to begin to have a material shift in how this whole thing is being managed. But it's not going to come from the technologists, and it's not going to come from the governments. You know, there's also, you know, there's a whole group of what are called techno-utopians. Their stance is the answer will come from technology itself. Like AI will somehow become self-managing and there won't be any terrible unintended consequences. And I'm like, I just think that's profoundly naive or self-serving because, you know, they make more money based on how much technology they sell.
So. Chris Colbert is the author of the new book, Technology is Dead, The Path to a More Human Future. Chris, thank you very much for spending time with us. It's great to have you aboard. I appreciate you being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for caring. I really appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you very much.
You too. Bye.
Again, the name of the book is Technology is Dead, published by CRC Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.